Triathlon Show 273. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview James Teagle, my fellow scientific triathlon coach. He's back on the podcast, and our topic for today is how best to train and prepare and also execute sprint and Olympic distance at triathlon races. We'll dive right into it after thanking our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Precision Hydration create electrolyte products that you can match to your individual sweat sodium concentration level. So you can have a strong electrolyte supplement if you lose a lot of sodium in your sweat, or a lighter one if you lose less. And they make it really easy for you to figure out where you should be, because they have a free online sweat test that you can take to get a good validated ballpark estimate for how much sodium you lose in your sweat, and also what your sweat rate might be. So how much fluid should you consume in total. So that after taking that sweat test, you will have actually a hydration plan complete for whatever goal race you put in that questionnaire. It just takes a few minutes to complete, so well worth the effort. And then if you want to buy Precision Hydration electrolytes, you can do that with a 15% discount using the code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world-leading manufacturers of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. I want to highlight a product today that I haven't talked about that much before, but it's the neoprene shorts, the Roka Sim shorts. They can be a real lifesaver when you try to get in a quality swim session on days when you might carry a lot of fatigue in your legs, or your legs just feel generally sinky for some reason. Just put on the neoprene shorts and you get that little extra buoyancy and can still focus on having a really good stroke, really good stroke mechanics, and getting a really good workout in despite the fact that you might have had that fatigue or just heavy legs after perhaps a hard bike or run earlier. You can get 20% off your Roka order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. So let's get into the interview with James Teagle. Just a quick apology in advance. I had a day of pretty bad allergies when doing this interview, so you might hear that in my voice, especially towards the end, I think. But let's just pray that James do most of the talking anyway, and you don't have to deal with that too much. So here we go, Coach James Teagle of Scientific Triathlon. So we're back with another podcast episode with Scientific Triathlon coach James Teagle. James, hello, how are you doing?
Hi, great. As well as you can be at this time. Nothing to complain about, and it's great to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you, and we have an exciting topic here that has been requested by a lot of listeners. So this will be a really interesting discussion, I think, about sprint and Olympic distance training, and particularly as it pertains to age groupers. Before we get into that, though, can you just remind the listeners that may not have heard your previous appearances on the podcast kind of what your background in racing and in coaching is? Just a brief intro, so to say.
So, yeah, on the race side of things, so I'm a British athlete, and I've been lucky enough to race in numerous championships on the Olympic and sprint distance scene, draft legal. I've been lucky to go to junior worlds, under 23 worlds, senior Europeans, racing World Cups, that kind of thing. So, I've enjoyed my career there, and I've had a decent career. On the coaching side of things, I've been working with you for 3 years now in Scientific Triathlon. Before that, I was coaching at local clubs, coaching at swimming clubs, coaching at triathlon clubs. I got my degree, I got Loughborough University degree, and that's where I was training as well. So a lot of my knowledge, well, early knowledge especially, comes from the people I've met and the people I trained with. I've had the opportunities to work with some great physiologists and some great athletes as well. That's me in a nutshell. I hope that's okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's a perfect summary. Absolutely. And as you said, you've been coaching with Scientific Triathlon for 3 years, and that's across the board from very beginner level to very advanced athletes, and all across all distances. And on the short course, you have athletes that have been focusing both on the draft legal side of things and non-draft.
Yeah, it's been really exciting. Yeah, working with a whole range of athletes, and yeah, I mean, it's not boring, that's for sure. Different challenges every day.
So let's start with the following discussion. When we're discussing triathlon training and training for sprint or Olympic versus long course, like half and full distance triathlons, what aspects of training do you think are similar, regardless of the distance, or the same?
So I think the thing to think about here and the thing to remember is a sprint distance, despite the name, is still an endurance sport. It's still going to take you, you know, even for a pro is going to take just under an hour to complete that. You know, it's not a sprint. It's going to be using, you know, your endurance system. So some element of having a good aerobic system, aerobic base, is going to benefit you across the board there, whether you're doing a sprint all the way to Ironman. So, you know, that's something to think about. And, you know, I feel like sometimes the sprint distance gets written off as kind of the new person's event, or, you know, the event that's less superior to a full distance Ironman. But actually, yeah, it's still an endurance sport. And I think it's important people remember that. You know, and as being part of an endurance sport, you know, you still got to think about the general fitness aspects. So arguably on a sprint distance, you know, your metrics like VO2 max are going to be more important. You know, if you're getting really scientific, you're thinking things like second threshold being quite important. Especially first threshold is still important across the board though. But yeah, VO2 max, second threshold becomes more important on sprint distance, but it's still important. You know, first threshold is still very important. And, you know, same with all the sports, you know, your economy is also very important. So no matter what level of, you know, potential FTP you're holding, potential threshold pace you're holding, you're still going to be able to be economical doing that. And that's true across sprint distance, where you're trying to run, you know, 99% FTP or threshold pace, for example, off a bike, as it is to, you know, you're trying to run 80% of your threshold pace in a 70.3 or an Ironman. You know, it's still there. And, you know, with that, swim technique is very important. You know, there's still elements of nutrition that are important, elements of being consistent in training, very important. There's lots of similarities across all the sports, even though the distances do vary a lot. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that if we look at the very, very world-class side of sprint distance racing, for example, right now on the men's side, Vincent Louis has been very dominant. On the women's side, Katie Zafiris over the last few years, before her, Flora Duffy. Flora Duffy might be coming back now again. Before Vincent Louis, we had Mario Mola. A common denominator of all these athletes is that when they became the number one in the world, they weren't like the new kid on the block, the 20-year-old. That hasn't really happened since the Brownlees, I think. Right. But they're in their late 20s when they really start to dominate, whether we're talking about sprint or Olympic distance racing. And I think that's a sign of just the number of years it takes to really fully develop your aerobic potential. And it's just a sign of that is still the most important thing when we talk about even sprint distance triathlon, which for the elites of the elites takes less than 50 minutes.
Well, yeah, I mean, for the elite of elite, you're looking at that conditioning aspect being, you know, actually how much percentage threshold. You know, they've got to have a very good threshold and they've got to be able to run, you know, fast. But actually, how fast can they run off a bike? And that is what takes a long time to develop, I think. But actually being able to run fast off a bike, having that conditioning aspect, you know, you might be able to run, you know, 14-minute 5K. Can you do that off a bike? And I think that's what takes a lot of time. But yeah, that's the elite of elite, like you say.
Yeah. So if we discuss base training a little bit, we're in early February here as we record this, and a lot of athletes are going through their winter training for hopefully a summer racing season here in the Northern Hemisphere. At least the Australians are already in their racing season.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you are focusing, let's say that you have a fixed amount of training time per week that you're training at, and it doesn't matter what it is, let's call it 8 hours per week right now, and we have athlete A is training for sprint and Olympic distance races, and athlete B is training for half and full distance Ironman races. Do you think that the training they should be doing is very similar in this time of the season, or if it differs, how does it differ?
It depends on when your race, your actual A race is going to be, first of all. So, you know, the classic periodized approach, you know, in that way, yeah, your training might be fairly similar. You're going to be doing a fair bit of aerobic endurance work. You're probably going to be doing a bit around the top end as well, especially for a sprint and Olympic distance athlete. But yeah, the similarities are, it is, like I said, it's an endurance sport. So no matter what you're going to be racing, you're going to have to do some elements of endurance. Now, as your time is limited, you know, 8 hours, you're going to have to probably combine some of that endurance within sessions. So one of the things you'd be looking at, especially, is, you know, what are the specifics of it, of the event? You know, you don't want to get too far away from that. Now, you can get hung up on trying to develop your VO2 max power, your critical power, that kind of thing. And yeah, it's all very important, but actually, what are the specifics of the event? So I would be looking at it and thinking, okay, what event am I doing and where am I now? And, you know, what does the event look like I want to do? You know, if it's a mountain triathlon, then you need to be thinking about that now as well. Probably less so, but it's something you need to be thinking about. You know, actually, are you riding in position on your TT bike? Are you getting used to climbing? You know, yes, less important now, but still something to think about. And it really does depend on the athlete and when your race is going to be. So, yeah, I mean, let's say an example, you have a race in May. It's a standard flat distance race, you know, you're racing Olympic distance. At the moment, you're coming off what I'd say is your standard winter block at the moment. You're probably just about to go into a bit more specific work. So you've probably been doing a fair bit around threshold. You're probably doing a fair bit of aerobic volume in that base block. And now you'd be transitioning over to doing probably a bit more sweet spot work, probably a bit more standard work on actually looking what your tempo pace is off a bike, looking at actually still incorporating some speed work there. But yeah, getting more specific at the moment, I'd say. And I don't want to, you know, this year has been weird. So that's a normal year. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. So to summarize there, you would, the specificity, there would always be some degree of specificity in the training. But actually now, early February, if somebody has that A race in May, this is already a point where you would start to incorporate a bit more specificity. So actually, like when comparing this to a very traditional view of linear periodization, to me, it seems like you would include more specificity, much earlier than the traditional periodization model.
Well, I think whatever you're doing in training has got to be specific. You know, you've got to know what you're training towards. And, you know, this is the danger of throwing around numbers, because when you look at a sprint distance race for, you know, a pro, that's going to take them under an hour. For some people, that might be taking 2 hours. So that's a completely different numbers you're looking at. You know, you've got to know what you're aiming for. And you should have decided by now, actually, what am I aiming for? What do I want to do? What am I trying to achieve? You know, am I trying to win the race? Am I trying to just finish the race? Is my first one? You know, that kind of thing is stuff that you should be thinking about at least. But you should have a good idea of what you're trying to achieve in your training, and, you know, being specific for that goal. It gives you something to target as well. But yeah, I think no matter where you are in your year, you know, you need to be looking at, yeah, what am I trying to race? You don't want to be racing something completely, you're training something that's completely irrelevant. Now, there might be times where, you know, you look at an athlete and, you know, 90% of VO2 max with their FTP, and okay, yeah, that's going to be a limiting factor. I need to work on that. And actually, it might not be that specific to my event. But, you know, that's fairly rare. Most athletes can get away with increasing their VO2 max by training. not a lot of people are actually limited by their VO2 max.
Yep.
So, yeah, it depends on the individual. It depends on your circumstances. But throughout the year, I would be looking at some kind of specifics to your race.
I totally agree with that. I have athletes that they had their off season, their 2 week break in the second half of October, and then they got back to training in November, and fairly early on, like let's say maybe their fourth week of training, we started doing specific blocks of Ironman training. So that might be just including 2 weeks, a 2 week block where a lot of training is really geared towards Ironman, and their target Ironman race power, in some cases, what the difference between the target and their current ability is too big. So then we focus more on the current realistic power. But with many, it's more like, okay, we know that your goal is this, and you're not too far off from that. So let's start by building up to doing 90 minutes of work on the bike, for example, at that race power, and then gradually increase that and keep repeating these blocks throughout the year. So the athletes that started doing that in late November, then maybe did that in late December and in late January again, and just including specificity throughout the year. So I totally agree with that. But then also combining it with knowledge of the athlete's personal limiters. Yeah. And as you said, in the example of somebody might be limited by VO2 max, even though it's not that common.
I mean, you hit the nail on that. You know, kind of what I'm trying to say there is, you don't get stale in your training. And, you know, if you're giving your athletes in November, you know, a crazy Ironman race day, big day, you know, okay, probably don't be doing that, but you want to be training in time trial position. You know, you want to get used to that. Yeah. You want to get as aerodynamic as you can, you know, that kind of thing. You want to get used to, yeah, this is how it's going to feel. Even if you are fair way from your racing, I'm not saying go and give yourself a really, really race specific hard Ironman. You know, this is pretty much a feel like session, but you know, you want to be racing, you want to be training a bit of that tempo work, for example, or you want to be training a bit sweet spot or doing some endurance riding. You know, you don't need a massive amount of it, and as you get closer to racing, you might want to do more. Well, you will want to do more, but you should still be thinking about that no matter where you are in season. You know, one of the things you can do as an athlete or as a coach is you can go and look at the courses, and you know, you can map them and map the files. You know exactly what you're up against. You can see what previous power outputs have been. You know, you can pretty much go and look at a course and think, okay, what do I need to do to perform in this race? You know, what kind of time will that give me? And, you know, it's going to depend on weather conditions and who turns up, but that information is out there, and you can use it to your advantage.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's something that more and more in the last couple of years I've been starting to use in my coaching as well, to not just give, you know, one race power or race pace when you're doing like some specific work, but actually it varies around some average race power or race pace and including those variations in training. So if somebody is training for an Olympic distance race and they want to be holding 250 watts, then a 15-minute interval at race pace might look like 5 minutes at 260, 5 minutes at 240, and 5 minutes at 250 at the end. So including those variations. And that's just a very simplistic example, but it comes back to that specificity aspect. And another thing with that is that when you get to springtime and the roads start to get really nice and clear of snow, and the weather is also better, go out and do that on the road. Can you actually hold that power in your race position on the road and not just in the perfectly sterile environment of your trainer and your pain cave? So those are all things related to specificity that are important.
And I think it's important, you mentioned it there, is, you know, when you think about a course, especially a triathlon course, unless it's dead pancake flat with no wind, you're going to have to vary the power a bit. So you're going to have to get used to that. So a lot of athletes I see sat on the trainer holding X power. Actually, especially when you get into that specific kind of phase, you want to be aware that, you know, you're going to have to go up a hill. And actually at that point, if you're chasing performance, you're going to have to vary your power there. You're going to have to go a bit harder if you want that time, you know. And then there's going to be different parts of the course where potentially you got a bit of a tailwind, you don't have to work so hard. So it's actually looking at the course and not just sitting in your trainer holding X watts, you know, for an hour. Actually, you know, you need to put a few spikes in there sometimes. There's a point in doing that sometimes. You know, you want to be able to ride at your average race power, but being aware that in the real world, that race power is probably not going to be, unless it's pancake flat with no wind, is not something you're going to be, you know, you might be able to do it, but do you want to do it?
So,
I'm a few better.
Yeah, absolutely. And what one thing that that I like to do is even with general training, like let's say a general tempo ride, in particular on the bike, because that's where you have definitely bigger variations and spikes in power compared to the run. In the run, you can quite often be very controlled and steady. If you're racing, of course, like competing for the podium, then you might have surges and stuff, but that's more rare on the age group side of things. But on the bike, like, let's say you have a 45-minute tempo ride, like, start every 5 minutes with a 10-second sprint. That's something that I use quite a lot in with my athletes to just make sure that you are able to stay at that moderate intensity despite having just done a sprint, which you would do if you, even on a pancake flat course, when you get to the U-turn, because yeah. a lot of courses would not be just one single loop, but they would, you would do them many times. Yeah. So you get to U-turn or you get to turn of some sort and need to accelerate out of the corner, and that's a perfect simulation of that.
I mean, going back to the base phase, it's a, you know, it's important to kind of throw that kind of thing in there, because, you know, you might come across these different aspects when you're racing. Now, typically when I'm on about, or when you're on about getting ready for a specific A race, we mean that A race. You know, a lot of people in a normal year will race many, many times. So it's impossible to prepare, especially if looking for the course, prepare for all those course differences. You know, you get obsessed with it. But, you know, you need to be preparing for that one race, really, or maybe two races. But, you know, having that in your skill set, you know, is not a bad thing. You know, it's not going to do any harm to have, you know, that ability to do, yeah, maybe 5 seconds. You don't have to be the best in the world at it, or, you know, you don't even have to be the best in your club at it or anything. But just having the ability to do that, you know, it's an extra tool in the toolkit. Yeah,
absolutely. So let's discuss some specifics that can be used around what we already discussed here with specificity. So discussing around the race demands of sprint distance racing and Olympic distance racing. So if we start with sprint distance racing,
okay.
And again, we're talking here from the perspective of age group athletes. So, and there are differences, of course, for yeah. the beginner versus the advanced athlete. So maybe give some of the key takeaways in terms of the race demands that age group athletes of different levels should think of.
I mean, I think I've already alluded, it is quite different whether you know, because if you're a beginner, your aim is probably going to be to finish the race for that first one. Whereas if you're an age grouper and, you know, you're fighting for the podium, or you're looking at qualifying for championships and things, and you obviously your aims, you know, the percentage power and the time you're going to be doing the event in is going to be a lot faster. So therefore, you know, they are different demands. Yeah, obviously with sprint distance, you know, 750 meters swim. A lot of people, whether they're age group beginners or you know, veterans, you know, that first swim of the year, the open water swim, especially in colder climates, you know, it's not something they're used to. So being prepared for that, and being prepared actually, okay, you know, you're probably not going to be able to choose your pace for that first 100 meters unless you sit right at the back. You know, being prepared not to sit at one pace. If you're an age grouper who's just beginning, then actually being able to, you know, hold the distance and swim the distance is going to be important. So that's something you should be looking at in your training, actually. Can I swim this entire distance? If you're trying to fight for the podium, then you need to be, okay, what kind of pace demand is that? You know, it's going to be, it's only 750 meters. So you're going to have to be holding around threshold for that kind of distance. Where potentially, if it's a lot of people on the beach with you and it's a decent race, there's going to be people around you as well who are going to be hitting you accidentally, hopefully. But just being prepared for that and thinking of specifics of, okay, how do I respond to that kind of demand of racing? And, you know, how do I respond to that kind of pace variation? You know, not just things like the pace I'm holding for the entirety, the average, but also, okay, how fast are we going around these boys? Because, you know, I want to get my head down. I don't want to get anyone, you know, even if you're at the back of a field, it still happens. So, you know, people can't see what they're doing in the water half the time. So just being prepared for that. Also remembering that a lot of the time when you swim in the pool, you're doing so without a wetsuit. Now, depending on where you're going to do it, you may or may not be swimming with a wetsuit. If you're swimming with a wetsuit, your pace perception is probably going to be slightly different. Now, you can't really use your pace in the pool in open water swimming anyway, because there's so many different factors that play into that. You know, where it's tide, other people, actual length of the course, because they're rarely ever accurate. So just being aware of that as well. But one of the things you should be working on the pool is, okay, what is my pace perception? You know, does this feel around about threshold? Does it match up with the time the coach has given me, or I'm getting myself off a pace clock? That's stuff you want to be thinking about in the water. Now, when you get out, when you get out of the water, as a, no matter who you are, you know, you got that transition. And over a sprint distance, transition is a large proportion of a race. Now, it's frustrating sometimes when you see athletes who think, oh, hey, it's transition, it's no rest time. It's not. It's part of a race. You need to run. If you're just aiming to get around that first time, and you know, you can take it a bit more chilled if you're a bit nervous about, you know, competing the distance. But if you're aiming to do well in the race, you need to run. You know, you need to make sure that's fast, and you need to practice that transition. You know, beginners need to practice it. Advanced athletes need to practice it, because you know, it's crucial. You know, you can lose 30 seconds in transition easily. Some transitions have long runs as well, so it's something to look out for. Make sure the run is not too long, or if it is long, actually use that to your advantage. You know, make sure you're good at getting your shoes on. Make sure you go to get your helmet on. You know, number belt, don't forget your number belt, that kind of thing. It's important, and it's important to practice that. You know, getting your wetsuit down, if you've got a wetsuit on, first thing you want to do is get that down. You know, a lot of people have trouble with that. So practicing that at home, good idea. And it's going to save you time. You know, it's a pain. Not a lot of people don't like doing it, but you know, when you're training for marginal watts on the bike, then you may as well do that. It's going to save you 30 seconds. So yeah, that's important.
I think especially for advanced athletes that have a long history in the sport and are at that point of diminishing returns in terms of getting fitter, and every single increase in fitness is going to take a lot of training. That is, improving your transition time is probably where you can get the most time for the least training. You really don't need to do that much of it, but if you do it regularly, then you're going to, like, just a little bit of it regularly. So once a week, maybe bring your wetsuit to the pool and practice some deck ups and some transitions at the end of the last deck up. So removing your wetsuit, that sort of thing. And when you get out on the bike, actually don't get in your shoes right away, but have them strapped with the elastics to the bike and jump on that way. So it's just adding another 1 minute to your bike ride by doing that preparation. But then if you do that once per week or more, then you're going to be that much better at doing it in the race.
And you can practice that stuff year round, right? It's going to be more on your focus, and it's going to be more useful the closer you do it to the race. But if you're nervous and it's something you haven't done before, or you're quite new to the sport, you know, the earlier you start practicing that, the less mistakes you're going to make. In terms of, you know, clipping in shoes and then going to elastics, you know, you're going to lose time if you don't do that. It's, you know, it's the skill that I think a fair few people are a bit nervous about doing. And, you know, because there's some hilarious pictures of people jumping over their bikes, you've got to be careful. But it's worth practicing and making sure you got that nailed. Because if you do that on race day and it's the first time you've done it, then, yeah, it's probably not going to end that well. You know, with kids, you do it with on the mountain bikes. You know, you get them just to jump on the bike and off the bike. You know, with adults, you could probably clip in on some grass or something. And, you know, with maybe a cross bike or something, or even on your normal road bike if it's fairly dry. You've got to be careful and take your time with it. You know, you can practice things like just taking your foot out when you're riding and then putting it back in without looking at your feet. That kind of thing is quite useful. But yeah, practice makes perfect there. It's definitely those little things that will add up. You know, if you get them right over someone who doesn't, you know, you can easily lose a minute and a half. You know, I've seen it happen in transition. So yeah, it's important. So once you're out on the bike.
Can I go back to a point that... Can I go back to a point on the swim there? So I think you mentioned pace perception, and that is key. And I think for the beginner, it's more about learning to not go out too fast, learning to find as quickly as possible your sustainable pace. And that doesn't have to be something that feels very hard. If you're just aiming to complete the race rather than compete for podiums or things like that. So the pace perception there in not starting too hard is the most important thing. But for the advanced athlete that is going for podiums, what is more important there really is to be able to start really, really hard and then still be able to swim hard after that, even though inevitably your pace is going to drop off. But the time is short enough that you should be able to hold on, even though the first 100 meters or so are going to be brutally hard. And that's something that you can and should, in my opinion, build into your training.
Well, there's several scenarios there. As a beginner, I'd just like to add, you know, if it's your first race, you're going to have adrenaline. You're going to go out hard. When I'm swimming, you know, swim at a decent level, when you're swimming, or saying for kids, a coach, it's like, if you're doing a 400 meter swim, you're going to go fast in that first 100 meters. You know, it's going to happen. You're not going to have to think about it. It's the next 200-300 meters you need to worry about. So, just being prepared for that on race day, actually, if you're a beginner, to hold back a bit. Yeah. Like you say, as an advanced athlete, you might need to go quite hard at the start. It really does depend on the course, though, because I've seen courses that are 100 meters to that first boy, where it's critical to get around that first boy as quickly as possible. I've also seen courses where it's just 750 meters straight. In that case, you've got a bit more, you can be a bit more relaxed about it, because those guys who go out too fast will end up coming back to you. The problem is, if you've got a really tight turn initially, and this is where you need to look at the race course. If you've got that tight turn initially, you are going to get strung out, because that boy strings everyone out, and actually trying to overtake everyone is really hard work. If it's a long way to that first boy, it's going to be more bunched up and it's not going to be so hard to actually move around the pack. So being aware of that is really important. Especially if you're racing at the top level, you want to be, you know, this is getting really technical now and I don't want to put anyone off, but, you know, if you are looking at racing well and racing hard, whether this is a draft legal sense or a non-drafting sense, we know that the swim will probably half your W prime. So if you swim hard, your W prime is going to be about half. So it gives you less match to burn on the bike. So that's something you want to think about, is actually the way you pace the swim is going to impact the rest of your race. Now, in elite racing, in top end level of age group racing, you know, you've got no choice. You've got to go with it. But yeah, just being aware that there's going to be a cost somewhere in the line to that as well.
Yeah, and I take that point. That's a really great point. I think that to some extent, even regardless of the course, you will have, if unless you're absolutely one of the fastest swimmers in the field, you will need to start hard because somebody else is starting harder than you, and potentially by starting hard, you can get on their feet and then swim faster than you would otherwise do by getting some slightly faster feet to follow. But yeah, you're right. It's a kind of a trade-off there between the benefit of doing that and the cost of having your W prime.
You don't want to blow up and be unable to swim threshold either after that first 100 meters.
Yeah.
But sometimes in those longer boy races, where it's a long way, say 400 meters to the first boy or 350 meters, you know, if you go out slightly easier, you know, for most people, you want to go out at a reasonable pace still. It's not going to be, you know, if you're looking at an advanced level athlete, you know, you're still going out fairly hard. But you're just saving your matches a bit so that actually you can build through the group when everyone who's gone out too hard goes backwards. The closer the boy is to the start, the faster you want to go at the start. Because you're going to want to be around that first boy as high up as possible.
Yeah.
For a beginner, it's a bit different. It's just trying to get around the course, you know, try and pace that sensibly. Don't get carried away with nerves. You know, because you will be nervous when you start. You go too hard. Just be aware of that. As a beginner, it's different for
advanced. Right. So
there's a difference there. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So let's continue with the bike.
Okay. So with a bike. So again, it depends on your level of conditioning, what you're trying to do. So percentage of FTP is going to mean different things for different people. If you're a very well-conditioned athlete, you know, racing at the top end, you've got a lot of experience, then you can be racing just under threshold to understand sprint distance. You know, you're going to feel it as you come out of the water. Your heart's going to be pounding, but you can be racing there. You got to know you can run off a bike with that, your legs, but you can be racing there. As a more beginner athlete, and it's going to take you slightly longer to race to complete the course, you know, you need to go a bit steadier. You can't be at that same percentage of threshold. So that's the difference there. You know, again, as I've already said, you know, you got to look at the course you're doing. If you're going straight out of the swim and it's up a mountain, you know, you want to be careful with actually, you know, where those bits are. You're going to have to go harder. So it's better to go harder up the mountain and then maybe relax a bit on descent, you know, if you're looking for the best time possible. If you're beginner aiming to get around the course, you know, you want to pace it, you know, as best you can. You know, the less variation in pacing, the easier it's going to be to you. If you're an advanced athlete trying to race as fast as you can, you're going to have to put different spurts into different times. You know, you don't want to go crazy. You know, you're still going to be a cost to it again. But if you're more conditioned, you can cope with it better. So it really depends on the athlete there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And again, like you need to train for that. We need to remind listeners of that. So if you're going up a mountain as you're coming out of T1, for a beginner, maybe they don't have a choice but to go at a higher percentage of threshold, maybe even at threshold or even above threshold, as much as they would want to, but they can't because of the gearing and the grade. So if that is the case, knowing that in advance and being able to train for that, so training for, let's say, a 5-minute segment where you're going really hard, where you're going at threshold and then recovering for 2 or 3 minutes going down the hill and then doing the same thing again, or if that is what the course is like, then that's something you should be training at.
Yeah.
And likewise, if you're an advanced athlete and you know that, okay, people are going to go out all guns blazing up that mountain and I need to be with them, then you need to train for that. And that might mean going above threshold for a while. And if the hill is, I'm thinking of a race that we had in the World Cup last autumn in Sardinia, I think, where they went up a really long, reasonably steep hill. And there wasn't that much pedaling going down. It was just kind of several minutes. There was pedaling, but not hard pedaling. Yeah. And so if that is your course, then you need to make the most out of the time up the mountain when you're actually pedaling.
I think that's what I was going to say is it does, you know, if you're looking at draft legal racing, this is where there's a big difference in that. If you're non-drafting, you've got a bit more control over how hard you're pushing. If you are drafting, then you've got less control because, you know, that those packs that form on the bike are going to be very important to how the race is going to unfold. So you want to be making sure that you've trained for the specifics of that event. So especially on draft legal side of things, you can end up with races that end up just being kind of just continuous sprints in and out of corners, which is a very different race. For example, if you go and race Lausanne or something like that, or some kind of course where, you know, there's steady climbs and descents, it's a different kind of training stimulus. So you want to be prepared for that. You get flat courses as well. So yeah, draft legal side of things, you really need to look at the course. But it also applies to non-drafting. You know, you still need to look at the course because especially if you're racing at the top end of that, you need to know where you're going to push, where the headwind's going to be, where the fastest times in this course. You need to have practiced your sessions in aerodition as well because it's fine having a great FTP set up like this, but you're like a wind block when you're racing. So you're not going to be able to hold the same percentage. Well, you're very rarely able to hold the same percentage of FTP in aero position as you are sat up, just chatting like this.
Exactly.
Training as well. So it's great. Look at the numbers, but don't kid yourself. If you're not in aero position, you're going to be able to hold that when it comes to race day.
Yeah, and being able to, as much as possible, stay in the aero position when going through corners, for example, practicing those skills of it in the outdoor environment. Yeah. And it's something in this Swift world that we live in is more and more important to remind athletes that at the end of the day, we race the bike outdoors. And, and it's the time from point A to point B or from the start of T1 to T2 that matters in terms of the bike at least, and that's not necessarily just how much power you can put out on the indoor trainer.
And when we're looking at that specific bit, training block, you know, you want to be training with your equipment at least some of the time. You know, you want to be racing with the equipment you're going to be using. You want to be on your TT bike. You want to be, you know, you want to have some experience using your wheels, using all of your equipment. You don't want to be leaving that until race day. You want to know how it feels with your deep sections on to get blown by the wind. For example, if you're in that aero position and you're getting blown around, then, you know, that's going to feel pretty uncomfortable if you're not used to it. The same kind of thing, like you said, you know, you need to be able to go down hills. If you're serious about a sport, you know, trying to win, you know, obviously if you're trying to get around, you've got other aims, that's perfectly fine. But if you're trying to win the sport, you need to be able to do that in aero position, right? And it's, you know, it takes skill. You've got to be able to do it. You've got to practice it. It's not going to happen on race day. There's so much, you know, you can go and train the power all day long. And, you know, I'm guilty of this as much as everybody. You know, I love going on Zwift, but you need to be able to ride outside as well. So don't neglect that. Don't forget that the race is outside on race day.
And what you mentioned there with in the wind with your deep section wheels, that's important. Something that I'm working on and struggling with a bit, to be honest, or not, well, need to improve, shall we say, is to be able to go fast downhill in the aero position when the roads are wet. I'm a bit scared of that. Not the most confident when cornering on wet roads. So that's another thing that can make or break a race if you do that well versus not that well.
Yeah, I've seen that. You know, I've seen that happen. You know, people who can take the course, who can't take the course, people are not willing to take the risks, but have actually practiced and know how to handle it. You know, and that's where things like equipment choice also comes useful. You know, you don't want to go on racing cobbles and 23 millimeters. Yeah. You can get punctured. It's not very comfortable. I'm guilty of that, but it's how I know. It's not comfortable. You know, you want to be thinking about the course. And you also want to be practicing it's not just corners and things, it's also road furniture. You know, triathlons take place in the real world. There's going to be bumps, you know, especially they often go through villages. There's often bumps in villages, so being prepared for that and knowing how that feels. You know, you're not going to want to slow all the way down, but you want to know, okay, do I come off the aero bars this? Am I feeling comfortable? You know, is my bottle going to fly out as well? It's something to think about, you know, because that kind of stuff, you want to practice it.
Yeah. Oh, personal anecdote. I have a new bottle carrier and bottle carrier adapter and new bottle cages. And over the last week, I have lost 3 bottles, 3 launches. It's absolutely insane. But it's good that I'm learning this now and not 1 week before the race.
Not on race day. Yeah. So, you see people riding around with no bottles, you know. Yeah.
One more question. So we talked a little bit about what percentage of FTP different levels of athletes can, but can you give some guidelines for if we're discussing here a more simple, flattish course with not too many corners or cobbles or like weird things like that, just a fairly simple course, what should a beginner athlete maybe be able to hold versus an intermediate versus an advanced athlete?
So beginner athlete, you know, we're coming in this from no sporting background. You know, it's pretty much just, you know, this is your first kind of endurance sport. You know, you're probably aiming, if I'm honest, to get around the race. You know, you should be aiming somewhere. As a beginner, being cautious, I'd say somewhere in the 80s, somewhere in the low 80s percent of FTP. The more advanced you get, the higher that percentage FTP can be. You know, at the top end, like I say, you're probably racing 97-98% of FTP and you'll be okay. But you know, that's properly advanced athletes. You know, you've got to remember it's still a race where you've done a swim beforehand. And there's still going to be some bits of, you know, you could be racing 100% FTP. But, you know, there's going to be times when you're racing over FTP. Just remembering that basically the more conditioned you are, the faster you are, the higher percentage of FTP you're going to be able to hold. The newer to the sport you are, the less endurance background you've got, the lower percentage of FTP you're going to be able to hold, because it's going to take longer as well.
And perhaps now that we're on the topic, let's do the same for the Olympic distance.
If I'm honest, the Olympic distance is not massively different. I would argue it's pretty similar. You know, on the beginner side of things, you know, you're slightly more cautious, you know, starting in the 70s and then building through. On the elite side of things, all the way, you know, for age group, advanced age group athletes, you know, you could be looking at 95% FTP, 94-93% FTP. And you're going to be looking at like 97% FTP for a pro athlete on that kind of course. So that's kind of your variation. It's still similar energy systems. You're still going to be using similar energy system, still, you know, you're gonna be taking nutrition as well. It's still gonna be fast and furious. So there's not gonna be a massive amount of difference there. There's gonna be a couple of percentage points of FTP, but that's where it comes down to the two events being slightly different as well. So you need to be, you know, you can be a fit athlete, done loads of fast work, but if you've got no conditioning in you, then for the Olympic distance, you're gonna struggle and you're not gonna be able to hold the same percentage of FTP as you would have been able to hold had you done that conditioning. So you see athletes who can race very well over sprint distance and perhaps struggle slightly more over the Olympic distance. And that's the conditioning side of things. It's not necessarily where their FTP is. It's actually how able are they to push their FTP. Again, it depends on individuals. Yeah, don't think that you can go straight from sprint distance and hold the same percent of FTP. You can't. You need to be able to condition yourself to do that.
I actually tend to be... Yeah, no, I agree with that. But I actually do tend to be a bit more conservative with the Olympic distance when guiding athletes to what sort of power to hold. For an intermediate athlete, I would say probably 90%. And the advanced, I would say that, well, somewhere between 90 and 95, so call it 93. And I've seen athletes get to 95%. It happens, but I think it's not something that I usually expect to happen. It happens on good days for a good age grouper that is well conditioned. So,
And that's where it comes down to knowing the athlete as well and knowing how conditioned they've got. Especially when you're starting to work with an athlete initially, you don't know you've probably got the background in training peaks, so you can use that as a bit of information. Hopefully you've had a full winter's worth of training, so you've got a fair bit of data there. So you can be fairly precise with that kind of data. But if it's, if you take on an athlete or you're an athlete who's just, mid-season decided to get involved, then you're going to have to be slightly more cautious about that. And that's where either you yourself need to think about it and think, okay, this is where the individual difference lies. And like I'm saying, I'm trying to get my point across here, there's a massive range. It kind of depends who you are. So, just because one person can do one thing doesn't mean you can do that as well. Or vice versa. So you need to think about that. Either you or your coach need to think about, okay, what's realistic here? What kind of athlete am I? What background have I got? And what power numbers would be realistic?
Yeah. And then let's move on to T2. Anything you want to mention about that? And then following that, the run.
Yes. T2. Make sure you know where the dismount line is. So when you go in transition in the morning, I forgot to say this, walk the course. Make sure you know where the mount line is, make sure you know where the dismount line is, and have a look if there's any road furniture coming into that dismount as well, or anything you need to look out for. Because a lot of the time, these courses are on laps. It's very rare you do one lap for any kind of race, maybe on sprint distance. But, a lot of the time, these races are on lapped courses. So, have a look, because often that finish shoot is slightly different. So have a look actually where the bends are, where you need to take your feet out. If you're an athlete, you're going to take your feet out. I mean, that's a great skill to get. So practice that as well in training, is actually taking your feet out before you get to the dismount line. And actually practicing just dismounting like that and what speed to do it at. And if you're going to do that, you need to know where the dismount line is, because you don't want to do it too late or too early for that matter. It's better to do too early than too late though. Unless you're racing, there's a lot of you and you're doing a draft legal race, in which case there's probably an argument you could leave it a bit later, but it's a bit risky. For most people, it's better to do it earlier rather than later, because at least you can pedal. To look out for, so that dismount line. Know the route into transition. So often the way you run into transition, there's going to be slightly different funneling in transition. So when you run out, you're probably going to go through one exit. When you come back in, you're probably going to come back through a different exit. And that's why I say walk the course, so know where you're going. Make sure you know where your bike is. So, when you come out of transition the first time onto the bike, you should know where your bike is. It's a bit easier to spot. Try and find some kind of landmark that's not going to move, that's next to your bike. When you come in from transition, all you're going to have is your trainers there. And the problem with that is everyone's got the same trainers nowadays. Everyone's running those carbon trainers. So, a lot of people are going to have the same trainers as you. So make sure you know where your spot is, because the last thing you want to be doing in transition is running up and down thinking, where is my spot? There's nothing worse than that. In transition, you don't want to be getting too flustered. You want to be calm-haired. You want to have like a process you tick off in your head. This is what I'm going to do. Take my helmet off, bike away first, helmet off. That kind of thing. Nice process. Have practice it in training. Don't make it your first time. Know where the run exit is, and then head out for the run. That'll be my process for transition. And then when you get on the run,
can I jump in there with some comments? So I think that the landmarks thing is really crucial, and I just want to highlight that. And what we're talking about here is things like buildings, or maybe a particular looking tree or some other big plant, flagpoles, portaloos, things like of that nature, so that you know that when you
something
have
when, it's not going to move.
When you have scouted the course, you go through, okay, this is the way I will walk in when I come into T2. I will walk past these first two rows of bikes or bike racks, and then I have this portaloo on my left. And at that point, when I pass the portaloo, I know that, okay, the next row is mine, something like that. That's how you will very easily be able to find your bike rack and your position in transition. And then even beyond that, knowing, so, okay, this bike rack is kind of, it is, there's one rack and then the next one that follows from it and so on. So I'm on the, at the beginning of the third one, for example, knowing things like that to make it really easy, because it's, even when the bike is there, even in T1, I find it really difficult to actually spot your own bike. And I have a very particular looking bike riding a Ventum, but despite that, it's not easy. Like those landmarks are just so much better and quicker to use to find your spot in transition, both in T1 and T2.
You've got to know that. You got to look at it. And then the other thing I was going to say is, you know, we've made it sound very complicated. It's not complicated. It's just know where your bike is and just find that spot and walk the course. That's all you need to do. There's no, like, you know, you don't need to count the number of racks. You can if you want, but you don't need to. It probably helped, but don't make it too complicated. Don't overcomplicate it, but walk the course and know where your bike is.
I agree with that. Actually, for me, I do find that it helps. Yeah. That's for me is the simplest. When I get to the right row, for me, that's just the process that works for me. It depends a bit on what the transition area actually looks like, but whatever it is that you do, you need to have done the scouting beforehand and decided that, okay, this is how I'm going to identify where it is. So. Good call there. You don't need to make it too complicated, but you need to know what you're doing and how you're finding it.
And the other thing I say is sometimes when you look at those maps of transition, or maybe it's your first one, you know, it can be a bit confusing. So I would, you know, those marshals are usually there and they're there to help you. They will help you. So if you're unsure on which way things work in transition, ask them. They're there to help and they'll probably want to help. So if you're unsure, ask. That's all I'd say. Certainly something walk the course in transition.
So just one more thing. Remember to, in training, when you're getting off the bike, practice dismounting the bike. That's something that is very easy to do. You can do it anytime you're out for a bike ride and getting back home. Just doing that dismount instead of just stopping the bike and then unclipping.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to lose a lot of time doing that. You've got to completely stop the bike. You've got to under your shoes. You've got to run in your shoes. Whereas someone who can do that skill, you know, you're going to save so much time. Running in your shoes for starters is not that fast. Running barefoot is not that comfortable, but it's better than running in shoes a lot of time if you're going for speed. If you're a beginner, then you know it's okay. You know, you're trying to get around the course. You know, don't do too much stuff at once. But yeah, if you're advanced or intermediate athlete, you know, that's a skill that's quite easy to learn to do. You just need to practice it a bit. You know, even when you finish a ride, before turning to your house, just do a couple of times of just undoing your shoes, like I say, putting your feet on your shoes, slowing down your bike. Don't even bother getting off your bike. Just do that a couple of times and then start to get used to the dismount. After that, you know, you can do it on every ride you do if you're unsure on how to do it.
Absolutely.
It becomes second nature.
And if you're a beginner, I would say that many of these things, dismounting, a flying dismount or flying mount, you don't need to do these things. I think the things that are important for beginners when it comes to transitions is just knowing where your stuff is. So doing that scouting properly and knowing where the mount line is and where the dismount line is. Do that, and then the rest of it, you can take it pretty easy. Don't rush things. That's the most important things. Don't rush things, because then you're going to be slower.
Don't try and do everything at once. You're going to get there, but maybe make that first triathlon your one where, okay, you learn, okay, this is what triathlon feels like. This is how it works. And maybe the next one, you're like, that's when you put the time in for that. Don't put too much pressure on yourself if you're a beginner. You're doing the race for the first time. It's going to be a learning experience. There's going to be some things that, you need to know that, you're only going to get out of doing race practice. You know, even advanced athletes, they've got lots of experience. That first one of the year is often quite rusty, even if they've done a bit of racing before that. So, don't put too much pressure on yourself, basically. So that's the transition. Like I say, just don't panic in transition. But when you're on your way out of transition, you want to be thinking about your run. Now, if you've got a 10K run or a 5K run, you're going to have your pace targets. Now, this is where it gets specific to the individual as well, and actually your mentality. I see a lot of people race out of transition really hard, fly and ready to go, feel great. A lot of people, jelly legs, don't feel so great, and it takes a bit of time to work into it. So, do a couple of brick runs in your training before you race. Brick runs for me, not massively beneficial in terms of physiology, but actually in terms of psychology and knowing how things work and how you're actually going to race, it's great. You need to do it. So incorporate in your training and just know how you feel so it's not a shock on race day. And practice running at your race pace in those as well. So don't just run off, as fast as you can because you got a K rep off a bike session. Make it your actual race pace. Now, your race pace is going to depend on who you are. If it's a sprint distance and you're a beginner, it's going to be about going out and, trying to complete a distance. So starting off nice and cautiously and working into it. If you're someone who's going for the win and going to race and you've got a lot of conditioning, you can be racing, if it's a 5K, you can be racing, you're not going to run 5K PB, but you probably won't be too far off it. This is the top end, guys, by the way. And then, middle of a range, intermediate triathlete, you're going to be running, you're going to have to think, okay, so this is a 5K, I'm probably going to run about tempo pace here. So tempo pace for me is anywhere from 85 to 92% of your threshold pace. So that kind of range as an intermediate or intermediate advanced. And again, the more advanced you are, the faster you're going to be able to run, the more conditioning you got. And then when we look at the Olympic distance in comparison to that, it kind of comes down to conditioning. So you can hold similar numbers. You're not going to be able to run anywhere near your 5K PB, but you can probably run somewhere near your 10K PB or not far off it, like 97-96% of it as a very, very conditioned advanced athlete. As a beginner athlete, you want to be cautious on that again. Somewhere down, somewhere in zone two would be beneficial. And then everywhere in between, you're probably going to get a lot of athletes in that zone three running, the more conditioned you are, the higher zone three, the less conditioned you are, the lower zone three. And that's irrespective of your pace. I've got 60-year-old guys who, very, very conditioned. Obviously, they're not going to be running the fastest times they've ever run in their life because they've done some fast runs when they were younger. But, in terms of that conditioning and things, their PB now, they're getting pretty close to their PB now because they're really conditioned. Whereas you're just taking up the sport, then, you're not going to get that close to your PB because you haven't got the conditioning yet. So just cutting yourself a bit of slack. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I agree with that by and large. I think that actually I would say that on the 10K for the very well-conditioned athlete, I would almost say that, you can run that right at your threshold. Whereas in your open 10K race, you would race it slightly above threshold. Not much, but ever so slightly if you're running like 37, 36, 35, 34, 33 minutes or so. And on the 5K, likewise, you would be, even in a triathlon, you could be slightly above threshold if you're very well conditioned. So I would say those as kind of the high end of what might be achievable when you're well-trained and well-conditioned to those distances.
It is very individual though. So just be, like I said already, don't compare yourself to someone else because you got to know your background. You got to know, okay, what kind of endurance sports you've done in the past. And this is where things like running economy become very important. Now, running economy probably to beginners sounds quite scary. Running economy is basically, how economical or how efficient you are with your movement when you're running. You can work on that. And this is where, yes, running a lot helps. It definitely does. It definitely does help. Just give me a second. Forgot to turn laptop charger on. Is that right? Sorry. Yeah, I'll start again. So it definitely does help to be conditioned through running. So the more running you do, the more conditioned you're going to be generally if you're running in good form. That's a broad sweeping statement, but generally true, I think. I'd say anyway. But you can incorporate things like strength work into your training, some plyometrics. Now, the strength work is especially important, I'd say, when it comes to running because you don't want to get injured. And a lot of injuries do occur on the run side of things. So if you incorporate something that's going to help out your robustness, so make you more robust, maybe some calf raises, some work on your hamstrings, work activating the glutes as well, because a lot of people have trouble activating the glutes. Their hip flexors are constantly on because they're sat down like we are now. You know, that's something you want to, you need to think about in the gym, and that's going to help you with your running robustness and your running economy. Incorporating some plyometric work, you know, is going to help with your running economy as well. You don't want to be too advanced, you don't want to get too advanced about it if you're a beginner athlete, but a little bit of it is probably not going to hurt. But yeah, it depends on your background of sport and actually where you are. But certainly, I'd say it's definitely neglected, is that work you do in the gym, that work you do that's not necessarily the run specific stuff that will help at the end of a run. Because don't forget, it's not only 10K, it's also 10K off the back of 1500 meters of swimming and 40 kilometers of cycling. So your running economy is going to be less at that point, regardless of who you are. But the best are going to have more conditioning and they're going to be able to run, as you say, almost at threshold. And if you're completely new to the sport, your running economy is not going to be great and you're probably going to be suffering for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and just going back to the beginner pacing a little bit, you said it already, but just go out conservatively. I think that a good piece of advice would be to take the first fifth of the race, so the first 1 kilometer in the 5 kilometer race and the first 2 kilometers in the 10 kilometer race, to really give yourself permission to go way slower than you think that you should be going, and then assess how you feel at that point. And then you can start to up the pace if you feel that, okay, actually this is sustainable for another 4K or another 8K in the case of the 10K. So, but have a specific, and it's not that if it's like as if 1K or 2K for the Olympic is any sort of magical or particular numbers, but just give yourself enough of a time at the beginning of the race to work your way into it and make sure that you don't go out too fast. So in that sense, put a ceiling on your pace for a given amount of time, and then you can reassess how you feel.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, as a beginner athlete, you know, run with a watch gives you a bit of perspective on how fast you're running. I say to athletes, don't worry too much about that. It's going more by feel, but that's probably more advanced athletes who would say that too. You still have some perspective of your pace. I say that, you know, what you just said about beginner athletes, age group beginner athletes is true also of advanced athletes, in my opinion, especially the guys who I say I know are going to go out too hard. So I say, look, that first K on a 5K, you know, make it easier than you feel. You know, going back to that 400-meter analogy, you're going to feel like you can absolutely, you know, it's not going to hurt you that first K. That first 100 meters or 400 meters doesn't hurt. It's the next 300 meters that hurts. It's the same kind of thing with a 5K. Hold back for the first K and then reassess. And then by the end of the race, you're kind of doing the opposite. It's okay. You're really pushing yourself and putting yourself in a bit of a hole in the last couple of K. But you should not be doing that on the first K. It's just about pacing and being aware of that. And it's knowing, if you're a coach, knowing the type of athlete you got, and if you're an athlete, it's knowing what kind of personality you've got and how you're going to respond to that. Especially because people around you, and they're in a race with you, and you're going for it. So, you know, they might not have it right either. So just be aware of that.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. You need to be have a plan for yourself and be confident in that plan. And then even when other people might be running past you in that first kilometer or two, just ignore them, because they will be coming back to you. And I think that applies more so than ever in the triathlon on the run, because that's when stuff hits the fan, so to say, and a lot of people will blow up. So don't be the person that blows up.
And be aware that things like the temperature and things like, even, you know, I've had race athletes go on race altitude. Just be aware that's going to have an influence on how fast you run. If it's really hot and really humid, you're not going to run as fast as you usually would. You're going to have suffered. And the same thing with altitude, obviously being aware that if you've just gone up to altitude having done no prep, then unfortunately, you know, a lot of people have that predicament because they can't spend 2 weeks altitude before a race. But, you know, I'm thinking of certain races here that I've seen athletes go and do, and just being prepared for that. Okay, your threshold pace and threshold power on both bike and run and swim going to be lower. Going back on what you just said about having a plan, that's something that I'd reinforce for any race, is have a plan. And, you know, that's got to be, especially if you're a beginner, but it doesn't matter who you are really, you're having a plan from things like, okay, what's my list? What do I need for the race? Because that's important. the amount of times I've left a tri belt at home because I think, oh, you know, you just forget the tri belt or something like that. Or, you know, and actually then knowing things like your nutrition, what you're going to eat on race day morning is important. You know, people get nervous on race day morning. So if you've practiced it, you should have practiced it in training. Practice your pre-race breakfast, you know how much you can eat, know how much you can tolerate. You know, get to the course nice and early, especially with COVID. You know, it takes a bit longer, probably getting a temperature check, that kind of thing, spacing out transitions. Be prepared to, be prepared for that. Know where the admin tent is, that kind of thing, you know, where you got to pick your race pack up. Things like actually knowing where you can warm up and where you can warm up. Important, you know, with COVID, a lot of people are stuck inside transitions. So you're going to have to go for a little run before you go in there, probably do some jumping on the spot, get your bands out while you're in transition, because that's all you're going to be able to do. If it's a normal racing scenario, perhaps you're lucky to be in Australia at the moment, or hopefully in 6 months' time when we can race properly, hopefully, you know, you can do a warm-up properly, but have it all planned out and know what you're trying to do. One thing I think everyone forgets is, no, and it's a bit crude, but know where the toilet is, and also know you probably want to take some toilet paper with you, because just be prepared for that. That's always one that catches people out, I think. You know, you don't want to be uncomfortable when you're starting a race. And obviously things like knowing the course, essential, knowing what nutrition you're going to take on the course. You know, if it's Olympic distance, you want to be taking some nutrition, even sprint distance, you want to be taking some nutrition, arguably, especially if it's going to take you a bit longer. Just having that all planned out. And knowing things like threshold pace, you know, what you're aiming for on the course, you know, that kind of thing is important.
That was a great rundown. And I'll also link to some additional episodes that we've done in the past on race plans. But that was all great. We've already been talking for more than an hour. So I have a couple of other questions that I do want to get to. And the first one would be some general advice, and let's pull the sprinted Olympic distance discussions together here again. And let's focus this maybe on the typical intermediate age group athlete. So what would be some general advice around things like a training intensity distribution? We already talked about they are both endurance events. We also talked about the importance of specificity. But if you were to describe like training test distribution, not necessarily in terms of percentages, but just qualitatively, what do you have to say about that?
So your race is going to be in zone three. A lot of it, you need to be training in. You need to have done some training in zone three. I'm not saying don't spend all your training in zone three by all means, but you need to have done some training in zone three because that's where your race is going to be. You know, if you're doing that, you know, that's kind of
because it might be in zone four, depending in a sprint distance.
Yeah, it might be in zone four. Yeah, it might be in zone four for sprint distance. So you need to be thinking about what your training you're doing and what the specifics of the event are. So zone three, zone four for sure. You need to be training in. Like I say, don't spend all your time there. You know, you need to be doing some aerobic endurance work as well. You know, it kind of depends on how much time you've got. You know, the more time you've got, the more aerobic endurance work you can do, the more extra things you can add in. You know, it's going to benefit you. There's a reason that pros are training 25 hours a week, 30 hours a week. Some of it is overkill, but some of it is also, you know, there's a benefit to doing aerobic endurance sport in the sport. So be prepared for that. You want to be spending time there. On the swim side of things, you want to be incorporating a bit of speed work. As well as your aerobic swimming, you want to be incorporating sets that allow you to get a feeling for the kind of training you are doing. So the kind of racing you are doing, So yeah, you want to be able to feel threshold because like we already said earlier, when it comes to racing, you've not got any guidance on actually what pace you're swimming. And actually because you haven't got turns and things anyway, it kind of becomes a bit of, you know, a bit of nonsense because actually if it's a tide, if it's waves, you know, you need to know how you're feeling. You need to know how threshold feels. On the run and the bike, making it specific. So like you said, zone three, zone four, in aero position, you know, if it's a non-drafting event, you know, making sure you've got that nailed and make sure you know what you're doing there, spending some time in those sessions, like we've already mentioned, you know, you probably want to throw in a couple of brick sessions there every now and again, just to make sure you're practicing things like transitions, you know, actually the feeling for running off a bike, that kind of thing. So that's the kind of stuff I'd be incorporating.
To what extent might you mention speed work on the swim? But you mentioned speed work on the swim. But to what extent might you include like high intensity work above threshold, so zone five in a 5 cent model, on the bike and the run?
So on the bike and the run, so I would definitely include a bit of it. And I'd probably stop including it so much towards the event. You know, I'd incorporate bits of it. So I'd incorporate strides and things, which is obviously zone five for a lot of people, or would be if you did it properly, in running. I'd incorporate the odd sprint in cycling. But as you get close to the event, you probably want to be focusing more of your energy on the actual race specifics of things. So incorporating it in training, incorporating it as drills, as things to open your legs. But the closer you get to the race, the less of that I'd do. Not saying that it's useless, just saying that I'd save your energy for the sessions that you're doing. But yeah, definitely a place for it in your training, for sure.
Right. Then the next question is, how would you distribute training between the three different disciplines, swim, bike, run? And also, we can throw in strength training here.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you've only got 8 hours a week, then, you know, you're looking at basically, you know, probably two swim sessions, two bike sessions, and two run sessions. You know, that kind of, for me, is, and a tram session is what you want to be doing. And obviously, in terms of duration of that, you probably want to be, you know, you're going to have to incorporate some different aspects to those sessions. So, yeah, for a swim session, you want to incorporate a bit of speed work, a bit of aerobic work, a bit of specific work to your race or your event as well. So what kind of pace am I going to be swimming at? So like we say, if it's 1,500 meters swim, you need to be able to swim 1,500 meters as your beginner. If it's an advanced athlete, you're going to be wanting to swim 1,500 meters at threshold. So you're probably going to want to do a session like, off the top of my head, 20 by 100s at threshold, because we have a bit of recovery in between each 100 so that you can actually swim threshold. You know, that kind of set is the kind of thing you want to be doing if you're more of an advanced athlete. Yeah, on the bike, you know, again, making it specific, spending time in your time trial position. If it's a non-jacketing event, making sure you're, you know, doing sessions specific to your event. So, you know, as we've already spoken about, there's a big range there, but you should be doing sessions in that range of, you know, where you want to be racing, as we get close to the run, as we get close to the race anyway. And the same kind of thing of a run, you know, on the run, I'd argue you don't want to be doing lots and lots of speed work. You want to incorporate a bit of strength work there in terms of tempo work. But tempo is a big range anyway. You know, it can be used to explain, to describe a lot of things. So again, that kind of tempo session, you know, if you're an advanced athlete, you're probably running 95%. You know, if it's too long, you don't want to be doing too much of that, it'll wipe you out. But it's just about making it as specific to the event as possible. So for example, if I had two runs a week, I'd probably have a decent warm-up, cool down, a bit of aerobic endurance in there, and then I'd make it possibly for a 10K, for Olympic distance race, I'd make one of them a threshold session and one of them more of a tempo-based session.
Yeah.
And then for a sprint distance, I'd probably change that for more, you know, I'd incorporate threshold work as one of those sessions, but in that threshold session, I'd incorporate a bit of faster stuff as well, so more down to VO2 kind of work in that session as well. And I would put a short tempo in there. So in that second session, I'd probably something like 20 minutes tempo, and then something like 3 by 5 minutes VO2 as a hill rep, something like that is what I'd go for. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So not being afraid there. If you have limited time, you're not afraid to have all the sessions include, or most of the sessions include, some sort of quality work at moderate or high intensity.
Yeah, if you got limited time, and yeah, I mean that's kind of the bare basics. You know, it depends on your injury background as well. If you're at risk of getting injured, you know, that kind of thing. You want to ease off a bit on the running side of things. You know, you don't want to spend all of your sessions in zone three or zone four, either. Like I just said, there's going to have to be some aspects of them that are a bit easier. And you do want to include the odd aerobic ride, the odd aerobic run, you know, as well as that. So this is, you know, that's just a standard week, but I'd probably, you know, do maybe two run sessions, and the next week I'd do one run session and then one aerobic run instead. And I'd be incorporating, you know, like I say, plenty of aerobic work in there as well. And then the more advanced you are, the more, not just advanced, but the more time you've got, the more aerobic work I've put in there.
Yeah.
And this again is remember for a specific block as well. So not base block, specific block. It's getting close to racing. And that base block, you probably won't include a bit more aerobic endurance work, but you would definitely include more aerobic endurance work.
Yeah. That's great. Great advice. And I think in terms of just describing the what you're saying there about the sessions including a good amount of aerobic work in themselves, there's a difference between doing, let's say, 1 hour run with 20 minutes at threshold with a good 25 minute warm up and 50 minute easier warm down, or just aerobic running after the threshold block, versus doing a 5 minute jog and then 50 minutes at tempo and then a 5 minute jog to end. The first one would be more beneficial probably in the grand scheme of things, because you will end up being more consistent in the end when you have both the aerobic work and not too much of that sort of really demanding quality work in the mid zones or even at high intensity.
And then for that running, you know, I wouldn't jump straight in and do 2 1-hour sessions either. You know, this is specific block, so I tend to favor doing a bit more frequency for the running over anything else. So if you got half an hour spare, you know, in that base block, you know, putting more half an hour sessions in is a better idea. It depends on how much time you got available in the week, though. So if you've literally just got, 6 hours plus the SREM session to do work, then yeah, you're very time limited. And it's got to be at specific times because maybe, you know, you've got kids, you've got work, that kind of stuff going on. But on the run side of things, yeah, I'd just like to add, I'd probably favor a bit more frequency of approach as well, instead of just doing 2 1-hour runs. Perhaps I didn't make that clear, but yeah, if you've only got 2 1-hour runs, that's the kind of stuff that I would be incorporating in those 2 1-hour runs.
All right, yeah. So you kind of already did it, but let's do it anyway, and that is to give one swim, one bike, and one run session a key session that can be used in that specific preparation period for an intermediate athlete preparing for an Olympic distance event.
Yeah, so I mean, something simple like 2100s is going to be great for Olympic distance
events. How long recoveries would you give?
At threshold. It depends on the athlete. So you could start off with a session that was 30 seconds recovery between each 100, and then you build that up to, you change the session slightly, but you'd probably go something like 20 seconds. You go 30 seconds for the first five, and 20 seconds for the second five, 10 seconds for the third five, and then if you feel ambitious, 5 seconds for that last five.
Yeah.
It's something I build it up. But you could start off with 30 seconds for all the intervals, and then maybe the next week was 20 seconds, or you could play around about something like 10 200s or you know, play around with the distance a bit. You know, if you're feeling ambitious as well, you could put 5 400s, you know, that kind of distance. But yeah, an example session would be 2100s at 20 seconds recovery at threshold. It's going to be a fairly decent session, you know. That's kind of the staple. You can play around with that a bit. The other thing to think about there is if you're more advanced athlete is I'd probably put in I'd probably do 1 week of that and then 1 week of putting some faster work in. So something like 50 meters hard VO2 effort, so just faster than threshold, and then 100 meters or 150 meters at threshold. Breaking up in 200s like that, and maybe doing like 10 200s of that with a bit more recovery, so just to get used to that pace breakdown. So that'll be another key session you could do if you were more advanced and thinking about pace variation. On the bike, on the bike, to be honest, I'd be working around your race pace. So, you know, if you're racing, you know, at, you know, an Olympic distance, then like we said, you know, you want to be training at a race intensity. So you want to be racing or training in the sweet spot kind of zone, you know, somewhere around there. You know, the more conditioned you are, the longer you hold it for, you know, you can play around a bit, interval lengths a bit. But you know, a nice session would be something like 3x20 minutes with 10 minutes recovery at desired race intensity in aero position. I think that's a fairly standard session. Now, obviously, there's loads of different ways of doing that and loads of different things to think about. You could do slightly differently, but that's a fairly standard session, I'd say. That should get results, you know, if your intensity is right. And you can build it up, you can extend the length of the intervals, you could put a few. Like we said earlier, you don't want to get static in there, so you could put a few the top end or threshold intervals. So threshold intervals, so you might do something like 4 by 1 minute of threshold with 20 session recovery into 12 minutes of sweet spot work, just to prepare yourself for the changes in, you know, course, because you're not going to be riding on a flat course with no wind, really. It doesn't really happen. So that's a way you could advance that session, or, you know, potentially just making the reps a bit longer. And then in terms of running, we've been over this a bit. So I'd probably incorporate a session that was around 20 minutes to 30 minutes of threshold work, depending on who you are. Now, if you're doing sprint distance, probably 20 minutes of threshold work, but with a bit of that as something a bit faster. So maybe a five minute rep of threshold, then some 2 minute reps of VO2 work, and then back to some threshold again, that kind of thing. And then for longer, you know, people are racing events that are, you know, Olympic distance. So something like a 6 minute, a 5 minute, a 4 minute, a 3 minute, and then build all the way back up to 6 minute from there at threshold intensity with half the amount of time you spent running hard as recovery would be a fairly standard session. So yeah, things like that. And then I'd probably, yep, the other session I'd make in the week is a tempo session. So a decent long run, at race intensity. So, you know, around 30 minutes for most people, you know, probably a bit longer if you're racing Olympic distance. And then, you know, if you're racing sprint distance, you could change it up. You can even change it up slightly for Olympic distance as well, but you can change it up as something like 20 minutes of tempo with some hill reps. So 3 by 5 minute hill reps as hard as you can go. Or some kind of, if you've only got flat ground, running with VO2, you know, another way of actually measuring your robustness I like to do with athletes is with a build drum. So you could do something like 4 by 8 minutes or 5 by 8 minutes. So starting in zone 2 and working all the way up to race pace and actually thinking, can I actually run at race pace having done that work beforehand, is a nice session to do to complement the tempo session. So maybe every 3 or 4 weeks, throwing that in. But yeah, they're standard sessions. I hope I haven't made that too complicated.
Oh, no, those are great. Really like them. Yeah. And so then if we take the final question here before redoing the rapid fire questions that you did a few years ago, but a summary of today's discussion, what do you think are the 3 most important take home messages to leave the audience with?
So, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this and, you know, it's quite hard to say. So I know there's a lot of things that I've mentioned and a lot of things that I think are important, but the thing is, the first thing I'd look at is actually know what you're aiming for. So know what you're trying to achieve. If you don't know what you're trying to achieve in a race, then, or you're trying to achieve in a season, then you don't really know what you're training for. So have that set out and have it clearly defined. It's got to be realistic, but, you know, your coach or maybe a friend or maybe your partner, someone can help you with that. And, you know, provide an objective view. Okay, yeah, it's realistic, or maybe it's not realistic. The second thing is, yeah, look at the specifics. So look at a specific event, look at where you're racing, look at what the course is going to require you to do. You know, you want to know, you don't want any surprise on race day, but you also want to know exactly what you're training for. So if there's loads of turns in the course, you know, you turn every 10 seconds, bit of an example, but you want to be making sure that actually you are, you know, practicing for that. If it's just going to be long, straight road, then also practicing for that as well. And then thirdly is, don't forget, you know, it's an endurance sport. So especially with sprint distance, it's still an endurance sport. It's the event that's going to take you an hour to 2 hours, that kind of region. You know, most people are going to be in that kind of region. So just remember it's an endurance sport. And yeah, train for it like it's an endurance sport. Don't neglect those, you know, those longer sessions and those aerobic sessions, or just the aerobic work in general. You know, and I'd actually like to add a 4th one in is, you know, just enjoy it. It's a sport that, you know, you should be doing because you enjoy. If you're not enjoying what you're doing, don't do it. But yeah, enjoy what you're doing, and try and enjoy the journey as well. And remember that training is part of it, part of a journey. Actually, if you're not enjoying the training, you know, you might not enjoy the race, or you might enjoy the race, but you got to enjoy the training as well. Because I think those two go hand in hand, and that helps with the consistency of the training as well, and it helps to balance the training. So enjoy it, if you can.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think those are all excellent points to finish the episode with. So now I just thought that we might do this because it's been a long time since we did this the first time, and these are the rapid fire questions, and you might have changed your mind on something of it. So let's take them. And the first one is: what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
You know what? I don't think I'm going to change my answer here. So I'm going to say it's still people. I think you can learn a lot from people. So I'm lucky that I've been able to meet a lot of different people. But I would, whoever you meet, I think they've got something to add. You know, whether or not you agree with them is just take what they've got to say on board, and you know, you don't have to implement it, but just be aware of that kind of thinking. Because I think a lot of time in this sport, you know, people kind of get tribalized and, you know, oh, that's completely different. And actually people have got things to add in. And even a beginner, you know, even coaching beginners, they add in things, you know, they see, help you see things from different perspectives, you know. So don't write anyone off, and yeah, learn from people. That'll be my take home there. Is I take things from people a lot. Sorry, that wasn't 15 seconds, was it?
No, but that's great. And next one, what's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
So yeah, I mean, I'm going to say my bike, my Orbea. I'm going to be slightly controversial here and say my aero bike, not my time trial bike, just because I just really love it. And the reason, yeah, I just really love riding my bike. So yeah, it's not, I think a lot of people would say that kind of thing. Yeah, it's what I enjoy doing. So for me, that's yeah, the best thing I've got.
And finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Well, triathlon's a sport where you often don't get what you train for, or what you want, what you're aiming for. So it's not to give up after the first time of trying, just keep trying and trying and trying and never give up, is what I'd say. And I think, yeah, when it comes to triathlon, you know, a lot of us in this sport are very dogged and we will keep going with it. Knowing when to change a tactic is, or change tact is important, but also not giving up, I think.
Yeah. And that's something that, I mean, it's easy to say, but I know that you really live to those words, knowing you. So it's not just talk. You're definitely walking the walk.
I think a lot of triathletes do, actually. So yeah. I don't think I'm alone with that one. Yeah. I can think of a lot of people who would do that. Yeah.
Right. And finally, where can people find you on social media? And do you have any idea where you will be racing this season?
So yeah, social media, mostly on Instagram at the moment. I do have Twitter, I do have Facebook. I do use Instagram more for that kind of thing, just yeah, sharing what I'm doing really. And race side of things, I'm going to race whatever I can. And I was chatting with you beforehand. I'm hoping to support the PTO stuff. I want to go with that. I want to try and qualify for the Collins Cup. It's a big game this year. That's kind of my aim, is to be racing Collins Cup and also World Championship 70.3. In terms of races I'm going to do that, at the moment, I'm not too sure. I'm in Marbella, which is at the time of interviewing, 12 weeks away. So might go ahead. If not, I'll be slightly later than that. But yeah, when I can race this season, that'll be good enough for me. I know where that is.
Right.
But I'm hopeful.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, James, for taking the time and sharing all this information with us. It's been great to have you back on the podcast, and I hope to have you back again soon for another episode.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. See you soon.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview with James. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and you can find links to James's coaching profile there, right on the coaching page, and also his Instagram. We will also have direct links to all of his previous appearances on the podcast, including both regular episodes and Q&A episodes. So they will all be in the show notes and in the episode description. On Thursday, we have another Q&A coming out, as usual. And then next Monday, I have another scientific triathlon coach, Lachlan Kieran, on the podcast. And we will discuss the balance between training load and recovery, and advice for planning and executing your training with that balance in mind. So stay tuned for that. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you're looking for ways to take your training to the next level, then do check out the training plans and coaching services that we offer on scientifictriathlon.com. And we're confident that we can help you improve your triathlon or endurance performance. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test to get a personalized hydration strategy for your next race. And use the discount code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15 to get 15% off your order. And thank you to Roka that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. And get 20% off your order with promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.